So let's start off, first of all, once again with the questions from last night, and then we'll move on to the other ones afterwards. So. Okay, dear Ajahn, yesterday you mentioned there is no permanent God within experience. It occurred to me that Nibbana is outside of impermanent conditioned experience in theory. There are monotheists who say that God too is outside of time and space, conditioned existence, etc. Is it possible that we're all talking about the same thing, using limited human words and concepts? If one were to attain Nibbana or know the mind of God or whatever, wouldn't that transcend human conceptualization? At that point, don't we abandon human attempts to define the undefinable? I know this is philosophizing, but I thought it would be nice to try to find some common ground if it existed. Is this valid? Is it valid? good question. It is. Remember that Nibbana is the idea of Nibbana is not really something. The idea of Nibbana is what is missing. Yeah. So when you attain Nibbana, you attain the end of suffering, and you don't really say anything about Nibbana really beyond that. And that is really sufficient, right? If you have the end of suffering, it doesn't really matter if there is something there afterwards or not. It's kind of irrelevant. And this is kind of the point about this, that actually what comes afterwards is really irrelevant if you understand things properly. And one of the problems is that is the sense of self. The sense of self usually wants to exist, wants to carry on, wants to be there. But once you see through this idea of the sense of self and you see that that is actually a delusion, an illusion or whatever, then the whole idea of whether something is there, whether there is a God or whatever, all that becomes irrelevant. It doesn't matter anymore because you see things as suffering, and then when suffering ceases, that's really all that matters because there is no self or anything permanent to hold on to in the first place. Everything kind of disappears. So from a Buddhist point of view, the idea of God is kind of misplaced. It is this whole idea of some kind of permanent entity which is always there doesn't really make any sense. That is not what Nibbana is. Nibbana is the extinguishment of defilements, the extinguishment of suffering. And that's really all you can say about Nibbana. So it cannot really be the same thing. Okay. Dear Ajahn, this morning at the Sutta lesson, you mentioned that the Chitta Bhavana can take you almost to the end of the Metta Bhavana, take you almost to the end of the path. Would appreciate if you could elaborate more on it. Thank you for your wonderful teachings. Yes, it can do, because Metta Bhavana is a very profound thing. If you practice metta, loving kindness, in the right way, it leads to the overcoming of all the hindrances. It leads to all the samadhi states as a consequence of that. You can reach all the jhanas, all the immaterial attainments, all of that based on metta. So it takes you almost as far on the path. It basically takes you to the end of the Noble Eightfold Path, just through practicing of metta, loving kindness. And of course, then when you reach those states of jhana, etc., if you then have a right view and you turn your mind in the right direction, that is when you can make that breakthrough and you can see things according to reality and you can become, then actually take with that as a foundation and go all the way to the end of the path through that. But of course, that is quite hard. It's not hard, but it takes a lot of it's not hard, but it's, it takes commitment to really go that far with metta. But as the metta expands, it kind of destroys or eliminates the defilements. And that is why it is so powerful. And the way it does that is, one way it does that is because it is a very strong source of happiness. So everything else fades away. You're not interested in worldly phenomena or worldly things anymore because you found something far superior. This is really what the Buddhist path is about. Sometimes we talk about dukkha, this, dukkha, that, but really it is also just an exploration of deeper and deeper senses of happiness. Until you get the final highest happiness on this path. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your wonderful teachings of the five kinds of people. How to deal with good people, but of different faiths. How to deal with good people of different faiths. Good people of same faith, but maybe different view. And last one, can there be liberation by faith for one and two? Thank you very much. How to deal with good people of different faiths. You don't really have to, you just treat them well, I suppose. Don't really, you know, deal with them all that much. You just deal with them if you have to, and you're kind to them, and you just, you know, just the standard things, really. You don't have to feel that you have to persuade them or anything like that. Very often, the most powerful teachings that we give to people of other faiths is just being a good Buddhist and doing the right thing. And then people often get inspired simply by that. And then they think, wow, they are a Buddhist. I'm something else. Maybe Buddhism is better or something like that. You know how it works. People get inspired by your actions. So I'm not sure exactly what you have in mind there, but there's nothing all that much you have to do. Good people of the same faith, but maybe of different views. Again, all we can really do in this world is not to try to persuade other people too much that we are right and they are wrong. Sometimes we don't even know if we are right, right? We kind of, okay, we think this is right, but we're not entirely sure sometimes. So sometimes it's better to kind of get our own act together, so to speak, before we start kind of teaching others. But sometimes we have a feeling that we are right and somebody else is wrong. And of course, there's nothing wrong with teaching somebody if they are open to that, as long as you don't kind of try to shove it down the throat or something. Then it becomes difficult, right? That's when it leads to disharmony and problems, when we try to kind of convert other people. But if you do things gently and we do things without too much attachment to what we're doing, then there is no problem there. Can there be liberation by faith for the two previous ones? Liberation is a gradual thing, right? So even when you come into a state of, you meditate and you feel more liberated, you feel that mindfulness is improving, you're getting a bit of samadhi on your breath or whatever, that's already a degree of liberation, because you are liberated from the defilements of the mind. The defilements that make us unliberated, they are the ones that make us feel like prisoners. So every stage on the path that you move forward, you are feeling more liberated. And anyone from any religion should be able to attain at least some degree of samadhi, right? Because these are states where you don't actually need any. Some views are suitable, some perhaps not so suitable, but believing in God should not normally be a problem. It shouldn't really stop you from attaining samadhi. So you do that, but going beyond the samadhi experience to going to insight is, of course, very difficult if you have a view that there is some eternal, permanent entity in the world. If you think that there is something eternal in the world, a permanent entity, a creator God who created you and created everything else, then of course that will tend to be affirmed once you get to the stages of samadhi. It will be affirmed because it will seem like God. Wow, this is really, really neat. This is so powerful. There's almost no sense of self here. I can't see any sense of self. It's so solid, right? This seems kind of permanent. This must be God. Okay, I found God. And of course, then if you think you found God, then you're not going to go beyond that and go and maybe see those things for what they actually are. This is just a Buddhist view, right? This is how I would see things from a Buddhist point of view. So there is a degree of liberation that's possible for people of almost any faith, unless you have faith in something really evil, like, you know, being bad or whatever. But otherwise, it is possible to go a long way. But it is very hard to go that very last little bit of the path if you have the kind of view of things being permanent and being everlasting. Okay. Dear Ajahn Ramali, thank you for being such a wonderful teacher. Wow, it's very, very nice. Your sense of humor makes it fun to learn the Dhamma. Okay, well, I kind of try desperately to keep up with Ajahn Brahm, which is really hard. So he's kind of always ahead when it comes to making it fun. I'm still confused about the concept of no self. I always thought we were parts of the same energy from the source, and once we had got rid of our defilements and attachments, we achieved nibbana and then returned to the source and got absorbed. Is this right? If not, we get transferred to the next life when we die. What holds our karma when we move from this life to the next life? With so much love and metta. Okay, so the idea of no self is that there is, basically just means that there's nothing permanent. There's no permanent core to a human being. Yeah, you look inside of yourself, you never find the core, final essence, permanent essence, which is the real you. That is not to be found. So once you overcome the defilements and all of these kind of things, and you achieve nibbana, then that's it. You know, you have achieved the end of everything. You have achieved the highest happiness, and you're content with that. You don't really want to go to a source or anything like that, because from a Buddhist point of view, the idea of a source would just be another impermanent entity, another problem that arises. It would be like going to a new rebirth, in a sense. So this is what samadhi is all about. The idea of samadhi is almost like a feeling of going to the source. Because when you have samadhi, you feel fulfilled. You feel complete. You feel nothing is missing. You feel blissed out. You feel unified. You feel like your sense of self has disappeared. All of these really powerful things happen. And most people would say, that's the source, right? This is it. I don't want to go any further. And if you already have a view of God, you will say, well, this must be God. This is the ground of consciousness or whatever, all of that kind of stuff. But in Buddhism, all of these things are also seen as made up. They are constructed through karma. They are constructed by our volitional, through our will, by practicing the jhanas and practicing samadhi and these kind of things. And for that reason, they're not really permanent. You have to go beyond those as well. And this is where Buddhism is kind of quite radical compared to other teachings. Because you go beyond everything that is experienceable, you go beyond all of that. And that is where you find the highest happiness from the Buddhist point of view. It is very profound and it's very hard to understand. And the reason why it is so hard to understand, again, is because the sense of self gets in the way for us to be able to understand this. How can the ending of everything be the highest happiness? And the reason you can't get that is because the sense of self says, no, I want to be there to experience it. And because I want to be there to experience it, then you can't let go of those things. So who gets transferred to the next life when we die? What holds our karma when we move from this life to the next? And it is just a stream of consciousness. The stream of consciousness is almost like a river. If you imagine a river, right? A river is always changing. If you look at one particular point in a river or a stream, it is never the same water molecule that passes that point. It is always changing, always something else. Yeah. Always something new passing that particular point. But at the same time, even though it is always renewing itself, nothing permanent is there, the overall shape of the river stays roughly the same. In the same way, the mind is like a stream of consciousness. There's nothing really going between one point and the next one. But the overall sense of personality tends to have a certain shape to it. We can recognize ourselves over time, right? This is me, certain character traits that tend to move along over time. So that simile of the river, I think, gives you a little bit of idea of what's going on. And it's exactly the same thing across lives as you have in this life. So in this life, there is nothing really going across, but there is some shape, if you like, that kind of moves along, and that's why you can recognize yourself from 10 years ago to now. And if you move on to the next life, it's the same thing. You can recognize yourself because the mind goes along. That mind carries the habits, carries the karma, if you like, and then you can see the continuity despite the change. So that is roughly how these things work. Okay, Dear Ajahn, since we are all vegetarians this week, I thought I might ask these questions. Did the Buddha recommend vegetarianism? If so, why? If not, why not? Lots of metta. He didn't really say anything about vegetarianism. He didn't say that one should be or should not be. What he said was that you shouldn't kill living beings. That's what the first precept is about. He didn't actually go beyond that. So I think the point, as I understand it is that very intention to kill that is the biggest problem that stops you on the spiritual path. If you have an intention to kill, that is actually the kind of very strong, very strong negative feeling inside. That is my personal experience as well. I remember in lay life sometimes I remember once I shot a bird more or less by accident, but it felt very, very bad when I did that. And it never felt the same feeling when you buy meat or you prepare meat. It never had that powerful impact on your mind in the same way. I think the main reason why the Buddha did not recommend this, or he didn't not recommend it, but he didn't say anything about it, especially for monastics, is that you have to rely on what people give you. When you go out and people give you something, you can't really say no. So you accept what people give you. And I think this is one of the reasons. But he also didn't say to lay people that they should be vegetarian. The idea is that it is the act of killing that really is detrimental to your practice of the path. But this doesn't mean that vegetarianism isn't good. I think vegetarianism still is a good thing to do. And of course, especially in this day and age, the meat industry is very different from it was at the time of the Buddha. And animals get treated, I think it's fair to say, far more harshly today than they did at that time. So I personally think it's still a nice idea to be a vegetarian, especially if you feel so inclined and you feel that it is something that you would like to do because of, you know, just out of compassion for animals, then great, go ahead and do that. I think I would certainly never object to anyone being a vegetarian. But do it in a nice way, right? Don't do it and become too kind of hot-headed about and this kind of thing, because if you do that, then often you destroy some of the kindness that comes from that. The idea is to do it because you feel good about it, and then it becomes a positive force in your own practice. But I don't think it is. It is not absolutely required, as I read the suttas. It's good, but not necessarily required. Okay, so let's move on to the next questions here. Dear Ajahn, if when we die we can't bring along the Dhamma learned and the mind that we have developed during this lifetime, does it mean that when we are reborn as humans we have to start all over again? If so, does it mean the Dhamma is only for this life and to ensure a good rebirth? Thank you for your advice. No, this is the whole point, right? Remember the simile I was talking about this morning about the what you bring along from one life to the next one? I was talking about what we should invest in, which has a long-term outcome and which actually brings you happiness in the long term. And the point of that simile was precisely that there are things that just belong to this life. When you die, you have to give it all up. And that is where you don't want to invest too much in that because you have to give it up. So instead, you invest in those things that you can bring along with you into the future. Yeah. So that was kind of the point of that simile, is that you do precisely bring with you those things that you have developed in this life. So if you develop your mind in this life, you develop kindness, you gain new habits, you will bring those habits with you into the future life. And this is the beauty of this. And this is what we mean by continuity from one life to the next one. It's precisely that you bring those personal character traits, you bring them along from this life into the future. And the same thing with the Dhamma in many ways as well. If you learn a lot of Dhamma and you understand what these teachings are about, then you will tend to recognize it in the future life. This was, I think I mentioned this before, I was talking about my own experience when I heard the Dhamma for the first time, I felt I recognized something. I thought, wow, this is really good. Where does that come from? And I think it comes from the past life experience. And it's the same for all of us. The Dhamma that you learn in this life, you may not be able to remember verbatim, you know, word for word what you learned, but you have a general kind of attraction towards these teachings and a general sense of inclination towards that. And then in the future life, when somebody then recites a Dhamma teaching, you think, why? What is this? Something familiar about this. Something nice about this. And that is what happens when you then come to the future life. And there is a sutta about this. There is a sutta about everything. If you know how to interpret the suttas and know where to look, everything is there, right? Every answer you ever wanted is there, especially if you know how to draw out the implications properly of these things. And that sutta says, has about the person who has practicing in this life, and then they die and they get reborn in a heavenly realm. Because what happens if you practice well in this life? Reborn in the heavenly realm, and then you kind of wander around, kind of enjoying the heavenly things. And then one day you hear somebody recite the Dhamma. You think, wait a minute, I recognize that, yeah? And this is kind of the point. You recognize it because you have practiced it before. And then when you get reborn somewhere else, you can then bring it into your life and you can keep on practicing it. It would be terrible spending all this time going so hard, and in your next life you start from scratch again. That would really be bad news. And that's kind of the whole point of this. We keep on at it. Carry on. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, when the Lord Buddha passed away, he established a clear succession plan to carry on. Did he? Okay. Maybe you know something I do not know. Anyway, so okay. Okay, similarly, one day when Ajahn Brahm passes away, not in the near future, I think you say, not in the near future, okay? He too has done succession planning. It is very clear you are the heir of that karma, owner of that karma. This karma originated in Norway. Okay, in no way will this karma change. Sadhu. Okay, well, I've got some bad news for you. And that is the Lord Buddha had no succession plan, nor does Ajahn Brahm have any succession plan. And yeah, I think one of these things, you know, one of these things is that it's no point in kind of trying to establish these kind of things. You just allow things to happen, and then when things happen, then you kind of make the decisions when things happen. So these things have to be kind of, you know, I think left till the moment when actually the moment arrives, and then you find out. One of the problems is that Ajahn Brahm has very good genes. You know, he will live till he's very old. And I am only, I'm not that much younger than Ajahn Brahm. What is it, 13 years younger? So by the time he passes away, I might have passed away first, right? So get somebody young. Don't get some kind of old person to take over. Get some really young, kind of energetic. You know. So we'll see. You know, these things are so uncertain. I don't think there's any point in thinking about that. But thank you for your question here. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, has meditating in the presence of an advanced meditation teacher helped you reach a deeper level of samadhi? I mean, at that specific time of practice, have you found any advantages in meditating with a group as opposed to alone? I think it depends. You know, there are times when practicing in a group can be nice. You know, if your meditation isn't going so well, you need a bit of momentum or whatever, then coming to a group can be useful, and you feel like kind of everybody's kind of carrying each other along, etc. But at other times, being in solitude is much more useful, because when you are in solitude, you have this kind of sense of freedom, being by yourself, being completely alone. And that gives you a freedom, which is also very powerful and very useful. So I would say it depends a little bit on the situation. And yes, sometimes it can be very nice to be in the presence of an advanced meditator, but sometimes it's just a feeling that an advanced meditator gives, not just when they meditate, but even just by speaking. Yeah, sometimes when I sit and listen to Ajahn Brahm, he gives talks at the monastery, and sometimes during the rains retreats, those talks are really deep and they are very peaceful and very beautiful. And you become peaceful just by listening to that. It's like you are kind of taking on board the feeling of what he's talking about, not so much the word, but the actual feeling here. And then you become very peaceful, and then you don't really want to move when the talk is finished. So it's more, I think, yes, it can be in the presence of somebody, but often it's just also the way somebody speaks and the way they talk, and that whole feeling about that can also be very, very powerful as well. I think the answer is a little bit yes, a little bit no. It depends on the circumstances. So it's good to try out both kinds of meditation, sometimes do it in groups, sometimes in private, and after a while you learn how to deal with both of those situations. Ultimately, you want to go into solitude, because that is the best place if you want to gain really deep states of samadhi. The group energy can only take you so far, and then beyond that, you really need solitude. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I can see my husband's progress, but not my own. So I feel I am a hindrance to him. What should I do? Thank you, Inveta. Okay, so you can see your husband's progress, but not your own. Okay, so your husband is kind to you, but you're not so kind to your husband. Is that what you mean? So just be kind, right? If you are kind to each other and you support each other in the right way, you're not going to be a hindrance to your husband, nor is your husband going to be a hindrance to you. In fact, this is one of the nice things about living a life, a married life, where both the husband and the wife live well and they live together, and you can support each other on the spiritual path, right? This is one of the best ways, I think, of living a married life or a life in a relationship. Because then you're heading in the right way. You're kind of helping each other out. And what a great thing that is. There is a nice sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya called the Nakula Pita Sutta. And in that sutta, there is a husband and wife, and they're both stream enters. And they have such incredibly good relationship. And they say, well, you know, we are so close in this life, really supporting each other. We want to be reborn together in the next life as well. And the Buddha says, well, if that's the case, this is what you have to do. And then you get reborn together in the next life as a consequence. And what is that? Well, what it is that you have to develop your mind in roughly the same way. If you develop your mind in the same way, you tend to get reborn in the same place in the future. So you have to have the same spiritual qualities. That essentially what that comes down to. So just be kind, just do the right thing, just kind of support each other, encourage each other in the path, and I don't think you will be a hindrance to your husband. I don't think that will be a problem. Maybe if you become too much of a hindrance, maybe one day your husband will ask you to leave, and he will say, go away, I want to be by myself. Sometimes when these things happen, you get husband and wife becoming monk and nun, right? That's pretty cool as well. That happens a few times here in Perth, and that's also quite nice when that happens. They're kind of moving trying to go even further on the spiritual path. Okay, dear Ajahn, when sitting, I have this pattern of starting out fairly alert, then going into a period of dullness. I'm not asleep, but just sort of out of it. Or sometimes I know I'm still keeping aware of the breath, but there is a heaviness to the mind, and feel kind of muddled. Eventually, it just runs its course, and the mind brightens up on its own. And the last part, the sit is calm and clear. Is there some skillful means of reducing the time spent in dullness? So far, my only way of dealing with it is to ride it out, which sometimes can take quite a while. Seems like a waste of time. Thank you very much. Yes, this is a fairly common experience. The reason the mind is dull is probably because you have been using it a little bit too much beforehand. That's usually why it is dull. There's something there going on, so maybe reduce some of that activity if that is the problem. But sometimes that's just the nature of the mind. Because you are doing other things, then when you sit down, dullness will be there. One of the monks that I know who was a very good meditator, he stayed at Bodhinyana for many, many years, and he always started out his meditation every time by kind of nodding And he was nodding away for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then he was clear, and then he could meditate properly afterwards. So it is a fairly common thing. I know this is what many meditators experience. And of course, the more active you are, the more of that dullness you will usually have before your meditation. So again, you are in really good company. Even Ajahn Brahm says very often he starts off his meditation, he just relaxes and just does nothing and allows kind of the dullness to come to an end, just leaning back against the wall, just really chilling out. And then the mindfulness arises, and then the meditation goes. So sometimes you have to kind of go through that stage just to get there. One of the ways of overcoming this, of course, is to be able to give rise to joy at the beginning of the meditation straight away, to think about something which makes you happy, makes you feel good about yourself, all of those little things, you know, just rejoicing at being here, being in good company, thinking about your good practices in the past and all of these kind of things. And that is a way. Joy is always one of the antidotes to dullness, because the mind becomes bright when you have joy. So try little things. Try to investigate for yourself maybe why the dullness is there as well. So gradually you will overcome that. And maybe at least next year when you come on the retreat again, or here or wherever it is, maybe you have a bit less dullness at that time. So see what happens. Okay. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned today about forgiving yourself for things that you have done. I often regret things I should have done, but for one reason or another at the time decided not to do. Do you have any advice for overcoming this regret? Also, does not doing something you should have done constitute kamma with metta? It can do if you deliberately don't do something that you actually should have done. If you see somebody drowning in the river and you think, hey, this is a good chance of getting rid of them, right? You're not actually doing anything, right? You're keeping your hands away. Then, of course, it's bad karma because your intention is bad. Your motivation is pretty evil, right, at that particular point. So if that is what you mean, not doing things that you really should have done in that kind of fairly serious situation, if that's what you mean, then yes, it is bad karma. So, but it really depends on what you mean by should have done here. What do you mean by, exactly do you mean by that? Is it a moral issue, or is it things that you kind of missed an opportunity to do something good? If you're just missing an opportunity to do something good, sure, that is also not so, that is not great, because we should really take every opportunity in life to do what is good. But you're not doing bad karma just by missing an opportunity to do good. You're just not doing anything, right? You're just kind of neutral. It's neither bad nor good. So that is no grounds for having regret for that sort of thing. That shouldn't really give rise to regret. It's more like a missed opportunity, which is a little bit different. The real regret is where you feel kind of your mind is darkened because you have done something which was unwholesome or unworthy. So that is it, I think. So the advice for overcoming the regret of things that you haven't done in a positive way. Just to let go of it and just to recognize that we never get everything done in life that we should do. We always miss some opportunities. And remind yourself, in the future, I will take every opportunity I can get, right, to do what is good. Because this way, you're maximizing your progress on the Buddhist path. So just use that as a reminder. But there's not much point in regretting that because you haven't really done anything bad. I hope I understood your question correctly. I wasn't entirely clear what you meant by regret there. Okay. Dear Ajahn, could you please kindly tell the Pali words for peace, gentleness, kindness, and calm? When I hear Pali words, I feel a pleasant feeling, especially at the Dana Hall when monks and nuns chanting time. Sometimes I can feel a beautiful, happy feeling all over my body. Thank you for the beautiful retreat. Okay, well, that's very nice. You're probably one of these people who grown up in a Buddhist country, and then when you hear Pali, it makes you feel peaceful and nice, right? Which is, of course, very good. So peace, a nice word for peace in Pali is upasama, upasamo. We have a monk in our monastery who is called upasamo, right? So you can go and check him out to see how peaceful he is. So sometimes the name and the character don't match 100%. You know what it's like. But it's a very nice word. Upasamo means easy, calm. So if that kind of works with you, you can use that in your meditation as a mantra, even, right? Upasamo, etc. Calm is really the usual word for that is samatha. Yeah, so you have the samatha, which means like the calm, the peacefulness that goes with vipassana all the time. Kindness. There's many ways of saying kindness, but metta is obviously a way of saying kindness. Metta just means goodwill, kindness, or you can maybe say karuna, which is compassion. Yeah. Or in the suttas, they often use the negative words like avihingsa. Avihingsa means, or ahingsa means harmlessness, yeah? Very close to also to kindness. Gentleness in the suttas, what is a good word for gentleness? I think soraccia means gentleness. So that is one of those words you can use for that. I think soraccia means gentleness. But it is not a very common word in the suttas, so that's why I'm not entirely clear what that means. But all of those words, kindness, gentleness, they are roughly around that area. So metta, karuna, and these things are nice words to use. So try some of that and see what happens. Okay. Dear Ajahn, a note to thank the amazing Bianca for keeping our bellies filled and her kindness to wonderful caretaker Christina Scotti for keeping Jhana Grove in tip-top condition. Also thanks to the gardener for the beautiful gardens. And thank you, Ajahn, for sharing with your wisdom. So that is very kind, and thanks to everyone who is looking after this place. Certainly Bianca is one of these amazing retreat organized, have been doing retreats, I don't know, probably longer than I have lived in Perth, actually. I'm not sure when she started out. What a wonderful service that is to the Buddhist Society. And of course, Ajahn Brahm, he always has his eyes over Jhana Grove to sort things out. Then there is Burr. Burr is the kind of Jhana Grove. There's many people involved, you see, in this Jhana Grove enterprise. Burr is is always doing lots of things for Jhana Grove. Then there is Lehar, who is involved with Jhana Grove. And of course, all the people who come every day to bring food. Isn't that an amazing thing? That people come all the way from Perth bringing food to 60 retreatants and everyone here and supporting us in this way. Isn't that a marvelous thing that this happens? I think that shows us some of the beauty and some of the kind of the spirit, the wonderful power of the Buddhist community in Perth, that we have so many wonderful people who are willing to support us in this way. It is very a marvelous thing. And a lot of the reason why that is the case, why that happens, is because somebody like Ajahn Brahm has been living here for 35 years and nourishing this from the root up, year after year after year. And after a while, you get a very strong and powerful Buddhist community. I think it's very rare to find this thing happening, traveling over an hour from Perth, cooking food for so many people, serving it up, and then going back home again afterwards. It's a very, very wonderful thing that is going on. So there is so much kindness and so many good intentions going around, and everyone here on the retreat is also helping out, right? Everyone, you're doing your little thing to make things work. So everyone kind of chipping in, and then we get a beautiful outcome from that. So thank you for reminding us of that, because it's always nice to remember the good qualities. Then we have all more metta and kindness for each other here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I've noticed that sometimes after doing many hours of meditation or after coming back from a retreat. I easily get irritated or anxious over small things. Is it because the mind has become more sensitive and I have been practicing incorrectly somehow, maybe repressing the defilements, or once out of meditation, they erupt again more strongly? Please advise. Thank you. I think one of the reasons this happens is because we get a little bit attached to the idea of being on retreat and enjoying meditation. Yeah, you kind of get into a nice routine and you are enjoying that. And then you get some attachment to that. And then when you go out, you have to deal with all the ordinary things of life again. And you don't really want to deal with that. And then if you deal with that in the wrong way, then perhaps you get a little bit irritated as a consequence. It could be that some of the defilements are a little bit repressed and suppressed as well. And then when you come out again, kind of they do erupt back. So this is why a very important part of this whole Buddhist practice is that continuous practice of kindness and metta in everything that we do. Yeah, and then if you really get into that, even on a retreat, if you really find that your defilements really do disappear in a very profound sense, and even then when you go back to your ordinary life afterwards, you will feel quite at ease when that happens. It will be quite easy to do, because defilements really are gone in a profound sense. Yeah, so just be careful and just kind of just do whatever happens. Whatever the reason is that these things happen doesn't matter so much. Just watch yourself and see your reactions and try to learn from that. And then as you learn from that, you can hopefully deal with it better next time around. Okay. Dear Ajahn, it is frightening that we may be reborn as a bad Muslim, killing Buddhists, or the other way around, as bad Buddhists, killing Muslims. So it is important to find a way to remember to be reborn as a good Buddhist, not a bad Buddhist, but a good Buddhist. Maybe our memory is not unlike a computer where all the unimportant stuff are kept in the machine, the body, and the serious interpretful stuff are kept in an external storage memory, the mind. This explains why people who remember their past lives only remember the impactful stuff. So perhaps we should make our Buddhist practice impactful. Be a monastic may be a good idea to make it more impactful. I see. Yeah. Yes, I think I obviously think being a monastic is a pretty good idea. Obviously, I wouldn't be torturing myself otherwise in this way. That's what it actually says in the sutta. It's very interesting. You know, one of the monks or one of the nuns, they go back to visit their family, and they come back with a bowl and robe, and the family says, "Why are you letting this shaven head and these robes and bowl oppressing you in this way? Come back to lay life again." That's what sometimes the families try to say to Buddhist monastics in the old days. But it doesn't really feel all that oppressive. I think that's part of the problem there. So make as much impact as you possibly can in this life through doing all the right things and storing it up in your mind. That's a nice way of looking at it, and bringing that across from one life to the next one. And of course, if you are a monastic, sometimes it is easier to do that as a monastic. I think that's probably true. Not probably, I think it's very likely to be true, because you are more fully focused on doing just that. Okay. Ooh, okay. Ajahn Brahmali, we need the right timing and right condition to be able to attend your sutta retreat. Your teaching is a blessing to us. When you said, "See you next year," it saddens many of us. 1 year is a long time to wait. Not easy to secure a spot for retreat. Householders with less dust, little dust in the eyes, are waiting, hungry for your teachings. Help! Okay, well, It's very kind of you to say that, and things are always subject to change, so we just don't know what's going to happen next year. There will definitely be one retreat next year, and there will be some weekend retreats as well, so just keep your eyes open, and even if there's not another 9-day retreat, maybe you can come on one of the weekend retreats, yeah? It's nice just to get the weekend out as well, just to get away from your busy schedule, get a bit more time to do meditation practice, even that is very nice. But try not to think too much about the future, yeah? We've got still a day and a half left, so just enjoy that while we're still here. If you start thinking about the future, you will destroy some of the happiness and joy of just being here, right now. Dear Ajahn, thank you very much for the inspiring talk. If one wishes to learn Pali, where would one start? Your advice, please. Thank you with metta. I would recommend you, if you are really, really interested in Buddhism, you might want to learn Pali, but for most people, depending on what kind of life you live, of course, but for most people, I wouldn't recommend it because it takes a lot of time and most people are already busy enough as it is. And it's more important to get in a little bit of extra meditation practice or do something else which kind of promotes your life in a happy way. Learning Pali is can take up a lot of thinking, a lot of time, and sometimes you don't get that much out of it. The translations we have now are fairly good already. You can use those, and learning Pali is not going to make a massive difference probably in how you understand the Dhamma. If you really want to go for it, I would recommend you to use a book called Introduction to Pali by man called A.K. Warder, W-A-R-D-E-R, Warder, A.K. Warder, and that is quite a good book, but a little bit hard going because you have to learn a lot about grammar and all these kind of things, but we have some recordings and things at Bodhinyana Monastery that I can always give you access to that explains what is going on. So that is probably the best way. But I would not recommend lay people to do this. There are some lay people who know Pali really well, and I'm very impressed that they're actually able to do that. But you have to be really specially interested. And also, it's good to have an aptitude for language as well. Otherwise, it can be quite hard going. Okay, Bhante, what is reborn? That's the question. Bhante, what is reborn? Okay, it's pretty succinct. I've got to give you high marks for being succinct. Reborn is the stream of consciousness. Goes in this life on to the next life. Succinct question, succinct answer. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, I have little knowledge of how Buddha's teachings were written after his death. Ananda Theru memorized the Buddha's teachings and passed that to other monks in India. Then how the first Dhamma Sangayana took place in Sri Lanka and later on in China? I'm confused. Please explain. Thank you for your wonderful teachings. Okay, so the first Dhamma Sangayana did not take place in Sri Lanka. The first Dhamma Sangayana took place in India. Soon after the Buddhas passed away, this is what they call the first council sometimes, not a very good translation, the first communal recitation, where all the monks came together and they recited the suttas and also the Vinaya after the Buddha passed away. And that is supposed to happen about 3 months after the Buddha's passing away. They collected all of these things together, and then from then on, they would chant or they would recite the suttas in groups. Because when you chant them in groups, you can weed out any inconsistencies and problems that maybe one or two monks have memorized something wrong. Maybe the nuns were involved as well. It's a bit unclear about that. It usually talks about the monks. And then you weed out any problems that may have arisen, right? Because it's always the case that some people get these things wrong. And then there were kind of regular kind of meetings together like this over time. And also, of course, in Sri Lanka, when the Dhamma went to Sri Lanka, it would have happened there too, until it was written down, maybe in the first century BC or thereabouts. In China it's different, because in China there never was an oral tradition. It was all a written tradition in China. So as soon as they kind of brought the suttas to China, they wrote them down, and they wrote them down in Chinese characters straight away. They had these groups of people. They had one monk who would then recite the text in Sanskrit or Pali or a language from India. Then there would be one monk, usually a Chinese monk or somebody who knew both languages. He would translate into Chinese. And then you have two scribes who would then write it down at the same time, right? So it was this group endeavor. You had this whole kind of team coming together. And then they were written down into Chinese straight away using Chinese characters. That's how it was transmitted to China. And the transmission to China started in the first century AD, early first century AD, with the very first transmissions. And it continues for many centuries after that. The main transmissions into China was by a very famous Chinese monk called Xuanzang. I can't pronounce it properly, so please forgive my pronunciation, but something like that. And he was very, very famous Chinese monk. You may have seen the famous television series Monkey, perhaps. Monkey is famous, and that's a kind of an adaptation of the life of Xuanzang, right? It's not actually what really happened, but it is an adaptation of the life of Xuanzang, who went to India to collect all the scriptures and things. I hope that helps. If not, please write down another question tomorrow. I'm going a little bit over time today because the meditation was a bit longer than usual, so just a couple of more questions. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, when a person has a lot of disappointments in the present life, giving up all attachments, craving, and sense pleasures, decides to end his own life, please let me know what type of rebirth he will get, whether he not be reborn to the world again as he given up all the attachments. Please explain. There are different ways of giving up attachments, right? There is one that is just really a suppression. It's not a real giving up of attachments. The only way you can really give up all attachments is by practicing samadhi and through meditation experience. You need something else to take its place. We all need something to hold on to. You can't give up all attachments just like that. You need to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. There is no other way of giving up all attachments. So if you commit suicide, you take your own life because of lots of disappointments, etc., then it is not necessarily bad karma, right? Remember, bad karma is always in the motivation, what drives that action. The action itself is neutral. It is the motivation that actually gives the action color, ethical color, either good or bad. So when you remember that, we don't have to be so sad when somebody commits suicide. We don't have to feel it's such a terrible thing. Because sometimes life is just so difficult, it is so hard, and then we commit suicide as a consequence. But if we have made good karma in the past, that karma from the past will kind of keep us in the human realm and carry us forward into a new life in the future. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for the beautiful week, listening to explanation of the suttas, including the interrelated aspects, guidance on the highest, biggest problems in meditation, removal of distracting thoughts using wisdom instead of willpower has already been helpful. May you attain Nibbana in this very life. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, that's very kind of you. It's very good. Okay, very nice feedback to get that. We'll do one more. Dear Ajahn, thank you for sharing your incredible regard and confidence in the Buddha. It is effective and inspiring. Is it true that Gautama, Buddha, was a monk disciple under the previous Buddha? It seems incredible that despite this, it then took countless lifetimes for him to attain Buddhahood. Could you please comment? Thank you. It seems possible that the Buddha, our Buddha Gautama, was a monk disciple under the previous Buddha? Because there is a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Gatikara Sutta, where the Buddha says that he actually went forth and became a monk under the previous Buddha. Whether that is a story, whether it is a real actually happened or not, it's a bit uncertain, because some of these things are really just stories, right? A story is told, and then it is a little bit unreliable to what extent these things happened. But it looks like from that that's actually what happened. It seems that way. But the point is that the Buddha Kassapa is not necessarily that long ago. It may be fairly recent. So it's not so much that he had to practice for eons and eons. It's more like a recent memory. Maybe there was one or two lifetimes in a heavenly realm in between, and then he became reborn as the Buddha Gautama. Or actually, he didn't get reborn as that. He became reborn as the person who was going to become Buddha Gautama in this life. So this is probably what happened there. So didn't actually have to spend countless lifetimes. So that's probably what happened. But remember that some of these things, we have to have a little bit of a kind of selective eye, a little bit of a kind of sharp eye when we read the suttas, because not everything is meant to be taken absolutely literally. Some things are stories, they are inspiring and nice. So we have to be a little bit selective how we read these things. So this story here, different people would regard it differently. I'm not entirely sure myself how to look upon it, but regardless, I think there is a good explanation regardless of what happens. So there you are. That is all for tonight. So have another good night's rest. Remember, there's only one day left, so spend your time well. Don't think about too much about the future. Enjoy what you have, and then we'll see you again tomorrow morning. Let's do the Arahang Sammasambuddho together.